Christian Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents God's Monsters, Vengeful Spirits, Deadly Angels, Hybrid Creatures, and Divine Hitmen of the Bible by Esther Hamori. Narrated by Lisa Larson. Monster Heaven. Every now and then, safari goers make the fatal mistake of forgetting that they're surrounded by wild animals, that no matter how well managed the environment may be, it is filled with wild things, dangerous to their core. The Bible is like that too. When we read these ancient texts, no matter how carefully managed they've been, we are visiting wild and dangerous terrain, and who knows what we'll find there. The biblical world is full of monsters. Uncanny creatures lurk in every direction. From the hybrid monsters surrounding God in heaven, to the stunning array of peculiar beings touching down on earth, and from giants in the land of milk and honey, to leviathans swimming beneath the seas. Most have been tamed by time and tradition. The cherubim, menacing winged animal guardians, have become heavenly babies, marketed for feel-good cuteness on greeting cards and framed prints to be hung on a bathroom wall. The seraphim, multi-winged creatures with serpentine bodies and humanoid hands, have become conflated with angels. Angels, meanwhile, have acquired the soft-edged glow of a Hallmark card, even as they are some of the deadliest shapeshifters in a universe teeming with bizarre figures. Other monsters are hidden altogether, masked in translation as natural phenomena, like the demons Pestilence, Plague, and the Chill, who'd be prime comic book villains, except that they work for the good guy. Who are the monsters skulking through the pages of the Bible? And what do they tell us about their God? Strange and frightening creatures have always surrounded us. We stumble upon them, or they upon us, in legends, histories, travel reports, medical books, philosophical works, theological treatises, and epics from all places and times. Wherever there were forests, there were forest-dwelling monsters. In every wine-dark sea, giant monsters toppled ships. The ancient and medieval worlds were brimming with so many bizarre, dangerous creatures, basilisks, ogres, giants, and all manner of composite beasts, that it's a wonder humanity made it to the Renaissance. Every culture has its monster lore, and the world behind the Bible is no exception. If anything, it seems especially overrun with monsters. The Bible is a collection of texts from ancient Southwest Asia, formerly called the ancient Near East, mapping roughly onto the region known today as the Middle East. And in literature from this region, as in Greek mythology, there are monsters spilling out the windows. From Canaan to Mesopotamia, people wrote spectacular epics and poetic masterpieces about their gods, including the monstrous figures who served them, fought them, and ruled among them. Being divine, you see, was not in conflict with being a monster. The best-known Babylonian creation story features the great goddess Tiamat, who's also the monstrous sea, complete with a tail. Marduk, who slays Tiamat and creates the world out of her body, is a gigantic, fire-breathing god with four eyes and four enormous ears. Sometimes, the monsters are divine, and the gods are monstrous. It can be more obvious who the monsters are when you're looking at someone else's mythology. When it comes to the Bible, though, even a vague sense of familiarity can fog up the picture. The Bible is made up of diverse texts that were written by people trying to make sense of the world around them, including the heavens and the earth and all they contained. It has an incredible history, texts from a world long gone, preserved and passed down for millennia, made new with each generation's reading. But this is also its great pitfall. These texts have been compiled and canonized, interpreted and misinterpreted, cherished and wielded. PG versions of stories are mistaken for what's in the texts themselves and mask what's right before our eyes. The Bible has been domesticated, along with the eerie creatures within. Familiar images like seraphim winging and singing and peaceful divine messengers ascending and descending might register to the modern reader as what is in the Bible. But beware. In those pages, monsters play freely, wreaking havoc and bringing death and destruction to their divinely chosen targets. What makes a monster? I teach a course called Monster Heaven, and on the first day of class, I ask students to name their favorite monsters. A few sea monsters are named. A sci-fi fan says Cthulhu. A rabbinical student names Leviathan. And a student from Vermont calls out Champ, which I learn is the monster of Lake Champlain. But then one person mentions the Wendigo, who's been devouring swaths of the general public for centuries across North America. And another adds the Islamic Ifrit, a malicious genie made of fire. A young man breaks into an exuberant rendition of Supper Time from Little Shop of Horrors, the solo of the giant singing man-eating alien plant Audrey 2. What do these monstrous beings have in common? That part of the conversation is more complex. Monsters have no single defining trait. Many are easily recognized by the blood dripping from their befanged jaws or the decaying flesh falling from their faces. Bodily anomalies are common, each type uniquely suited to the spread of its own brand of fear: the sharp and pointy, the huge and hairy, the grotesque and gooey. But even with the dazzling variety of anomalies in the Monster Compendium, they don't all advertise their monstrosity with some physical aberration. Next to your more obvious monsters, beside the gigantic thrashing sea monsters and radioactive killer robots, there stand little girls with ribbons in their hair. Sometimes the creepiest monsters are the ones we thought were innocent, but turn out to be very, very bad. Nor do monsters all share a place in the world. There are the naturalistic, like Jaws or Bigfoot, the supernatural, like succubi and incubi, and the unnatural, like the Yakumama, a giant river monster at the mouth of the Amazon that devours any creature unwise enough to dip a toe anywhere within sucking distance. Physically terrifying, or perfectly innocent in appearance, naturalistic, unnatural, or supernatural, monsters share no single defining characteristic. There are nice, succinct definitions out there, but they all fall short, because it turns out you can't pin a monster down. There is, however, a certain family resemblance, a collection of features from which monsters draw, in diverse and overlapping combinations, even across cultures, time periods, and genres. Heads up, every one of these features will come back to haunt us in the chapters ahead. Giant size is a common family trait, from the Kraken to the Mokele Mbembe, a Congolese cousin of the Loch Ness Monster, and from Mesopotamian Marduk to Hellboy. Superhuman or supernatural strength and power is another common family trait. Even among the emphatically non-supersized, like Chucky, Child's Play 1988, and other killer dolls, Ruby, Meg, and Supernatural's other young demon women throw the strapping heroes across the room whenever they please. Lethal superpowers, like the basilisk's literal death stare, are always a good show of monstrosity. Perhaps the most common monstrous trait is physical hybridity, the mixing of two or more species. Bizarre composite creatures fill the pages of works both ancient and modern, spanning genres from myth, centaurs, satyrs, the chimera, to tales of terror, from the highbrow to the low, the creations of Dr. Moreau and Sharktopus, 2010. There are other varieties of hybridity too, like being both living and dead. These are your entry-level monsters, like vampires, zombies, and every reanimated corpse since Frankenstein's creature. Then there's the combination of animate and inanimate, like the lethal car in Christine, 1983. Yes, these two will resurface as we explore the biblical monster world. Shapeshifting and realm crossing are also common family traits. Some monsters take different forms at different times, like werewolves and Pennywise of Stephen King's It. Other monsters cross between realms. A dead person who stays contentedly dead is no threat. But the moment such a soul crosses back over to walk the earth, a monster is born. Spirits might be innocuous, as long as they remain on some cosmic home turf. But problems arise when they cross realms to interfere with human beings, as they all too often do. The flip side of these traits of hybrid and multiple forms is the amorphous or formless monster, like Chaos in Ovid's Metamorphoses, described as a raw, unordered mass, and the invisible evil of The Haunting, 1963. Many stories of ghosts and evil spirits revolve around formless threats. Some of these are also shapeshifters. The looming threat of John Carpenter's The Fog, 1980, would be anticlimactic if the fog didn't shift into the form of zombie pirates who slaughter townspeople, which is wicked, even if the townspeople sort of deserve it. Then there are the monsters that would seem natural, if only they showed up alone. One bird? Fine. A horde of birds attacking en masse? Monstrous. Like in this classic example, The Birds, 1963, the creep factor doesn't come just from the countless creatures' activity, but from their unnatural collective will. These juicy category violations, from grotesque bodily anomalies, giant size, and supernatural strength, to forms that are composite, shifting, realm-crossing, amorphous, or countlessly multiplied, are the most common traits from which members of the monster family draw. No monster has all of these traits. All monsters have some. As with features of monster physiology, there's a common monster geography. Monsters usually dwell outside of human society, lurking in the liminal spaces and the places beyond, the depths of the forest, the heart of the sea, encountering people either when they break into human territory or when people dare to enter those dangerous realms. A recent Onion headline reads, "Report, leading cause of death still venturing beyond the pines." Monster life flourishes in the elsewhere places, mountaintops and mysterious islands, cemeteries and sewers, the strange old house at the end of the road. In An American Werewolf in London, 1981, an old man in the gloomy northern pub warns Jack and David, "Stay on the road. Keep clear of the moors." They don't. If only the monsters would stay in the elsewhere and beyond. The problem is their propensity to break into this realm. Like the creature of Stranger Things, who comes from the upside down but breaks into this dimension, monsters are forever pressing against the boundaries, threatening to breach our world. And how many elsewhere and beyond places the Bible has. All kinds of monstrous figures peer out, each kind manifesting its own combination of the classic monster family traits. In the heavens above, huge winged creatures with confusing assortments of body parts threaten interlopers. This is also the home turf of an array of brutal, realm-crossing divine hitmen, each having the terrible combination of lethal superpowers and the ability to cross all natural boundaries to use them, sometimes shapeshifting along the way. Manipulative spirits walk about in the heavens, but come sweeping through the earth like wind to pursue their human prey. On Earth, The forbidding, closed-off room at the far end of the divine house is guarded by fierce composite creatures. An unfamiliar land is filled with giants who are the hybrid descendants of natural and supernatural species. In the depths of the sea, the gigantic and indescribable Leviathan swims with his multi-headed kin. These creatures, the massive and the formless, crossing realms and shifting shapes with too many wings and too many heads, occupy every part of the biblical universe. Their very existence pointing to the God and creator of their world. When we see them, we are confronted with him. About that him, I use masculine pronouns for God in this book. This is because I'm writing about the God who appears as a character in the ancient anthology of texts we call the Bible, in which he's portrayed as male. This is a matter of literary accuracy, not a theological claim. For those who closely connect that character to a God they believe in today, the gendering of the ancient portrayal of God may be one of many things worth grappling with. The 5th century theologian and philosopher Augustine explained that creatures contrary to nature are called monsters, Latin monstra, because they demonstrate a monstrando, something. And for Augustine, it was something wondrous. Monsters of the Bible can indeed demonstrate something about the nature of the biblical God. But be prepared. God's nature isn't always so benevolent. In fact, this God may be the monster of monsters. The biblical God and his entourage of monsters. As the biblical monster population comes into focus, one chilling element stands out. The most dangerous of these monsters are in God's employ. They're not his opponents, they're his entourage. He's the one who sends hybrid creatures on the attack, who commands forces of demons and dispatches vengeful spirits, who repeatedly orchestrates the mass slaughter of civilians by his divine hitmen, angelic and otherwise. God is surrounded by bizarre, monstrous creatures, and they commit remarkably violent acts on his command. In fact, every single type of divine being that is shown acting in the service of God in the Bible threatens, injures, tortures, or kills on his behalf. Some are exclusively violent, like the destroyer. Others have multifaceted roles, like angels, who appear perfectly docile when performing one aspect of their job, but create mass carnage when doing another. Each type of divine being in God's service has its own profile, its characteristic set of job responsibilities, and every one of them includes doing the boss's dirty work. This is the heavenly retinue we'll meet in the first part of this book. Terrifying, serpentine seraphim flap around God's throne and burn a witness with glowing coals. Hybrid cherubim serve as monstrous bouncers and bodyguards. We'll see God dispatch the adversary, his enhanced interrogation expert, to torture and kill at his behest. We'll watch as God deploys stealthy spirits as psyop specialists to manipulate and gaslight his targets. And as devastating as the demons he sicks on the population are, they don't hold a candle to those most lethal shape-shifting soldiers, God's angels, who execute thousands in the blink of an eye, when they're not attacking on a more intimate level. Throughout the Jewish and Christian Bibles, from Genesis through Revelation, God commands an entourage of monsters. In the second part of the book, we'll meet the monsters of the sea, earth, and underworld. They don't work for God, but they have plenty to teach us about him. The activities of God's monstrous inner circle show us his character from one angle. The intense, heated dynamics between God and the monsters outside of his entourage show us another. Monsters can be lots of fun. I can grab the remote at any moment and see that I'm not alone in this opinion. But biblical monsters can also present some problems that those on the screen don't. So why choose to look at the biblical monsters and wrestle with such texts? For me, the answer is personal. A few months after my older brother killed himself, I had a dream in which I was trying to remember which one of us had died. I couldn't figure it out, couldn't wrap my mind around it. As years went by, and I ticked off each milestone, now I'm older than he ever was. Now I've lived longer with him dead than alive. Now I'm twice as old as he ever was. His death became less the focus and more the lens through which I see the world. His death, and after it, my sense of a world spinning out off its axis without order, propelled me into a long period of religious exploration, turning over a variety of ideas before finding my way back home to Judaism, the tradition I grew up in. Along the way, I tried focusing on the many biblical passages of comfort and hope, but taken alone, they fell short. Maybe that's why they're not alone. The Bible is rich with comfort, but also chock full of macabre stories. And with their recognition of a troubled reality, they offer something that the safer, prettier texts can't. Hope is all well and good, but acknowledgement of the grim has a comfort all its own. These monsters that I find so compelling demonstrate something about their world. Monsters have meaning. Monsters raise questions. Monsters make us think. What are we to make of the menacing monsters of the Bible? Is there room for wonder? Or, seeing that these monsters don't stay put in the elsewhere and beyond, but break dreadfully into this realm, as monsters do, might they demonstrate something else about the God who deploys them, or about the Bible itself? The Bible has been domesticated, muzzling its monsters. Sometimes our translations carefully sidestep the brutality of these creatures in the original texts. Later writers cleaned things up a bit, developing some characters in more palatable ways. A troop of hybrid beasties became a serene angelic choir, and the adversary was safely removed to hell. God, too, has been tamed. But this does a disservice to the original portrayals in the Bible. The ancient authors understood something about the world. These portraits of God's monsters aren't primitive theological drawings over which we can, with relief, superimpose the neater pictures of later theology, where good and evil are clearly distinguished, the heavens are filled with God's goodness, all harm is attributed to another hand, and everyone colors inside the lines. These ancient thinkers recognized that the world can be a sinister and dangerous place. They saw all around themselves the reality of chaos, pain, grief, violence, and fear. They wrote about monsters because they, like us, knew a world that was filled with monsters of all kinds. These aren't crude constructions, but poignant expressions of the dangers and afflictions of life. Far from telling themselves that the presence of God assured their well-being, the Bible's ancient writers had a sense that on the edges of their world, just beyond their own realm, all sorts of monstrous creatures were lurking. Let's meet them now, and the complicated, some might even say monstrous, God who puts them to use. Part 1. God's Entourage. 1. Seraphim. On a 110-degree night in July 1945, the USS Indianapolis was struck by torpedoes and sank in the Philippine Sea. Among 1,195 crew members, some 900 made it through the initial disaster, only to end up struggling for their lives in the water. Many died of their injuries, dehydration, and drowning. And then, there were the mass shark attacks. Corporal Edgar Harrell described what it was like to see the fins coming toward him in the water, to see a shipmate alive one day, and recognize what remained of his corpse the next. To hear blood-curdling screams cut through the sounds of the wind and sea. By the time rescue came, there were only 316 survivors. 72 years later, when the wreckage was found, Harold said the trauma lived on. The crew members' ordeal, almost inconceivable in its layered horrors, seems to follow the contours of a story in the Book of Numbers in the Bible. The Israelites narrowly escaped Pharaoh's army, only to find themselves dying in the desert, trudging through the scorching heat without water, stricken with disease, with no help in sight. Many are lost. Numbers chapters 11 through 20. Those who remain lament that it would have been better to die in Egypt, where they had been enslaved. And then come the snakes. Poisonous snakes swarm among them, biting and killing a huge number. Chapter 21, verses 4 through 9. From how far away could they see the snakes slithering toward them? Did they witness family and friends attacked and dying? Did they hear screams? It's easy to blithely bypass the horror of biblical stories. Too often, we chalk it up to being a necessary element of some kind of morality tale. But other great literature of the ancient world doesn't sacrifice meaningful engagement with human drama for the sake of a neat moral. Why expect less of the Bible? Whatever the Bible means to you as a reader, let's begin with the assumption that this literature, too, is richly textured, filled with the ancient writers' poignant reflections on the human condition. The story of the mass snake attack in the desert is horrifying. The people would be terrified, traumatized. What does a story this appalling reveal of the writer's thoughts about their God? Wait, you might think, why are we talking about snakes? It's because these particular snakes are sent by God to attack and kill God's people. And these snakes have a special name, seraphim. What's in a name? The best-known seraphim of the Bible are the heavenly creatures in the prophet Isaiah's vision of God seated on his throne, surrounded by winged seraphim who cry, "Holy, holy, holy." Isaiah chapter 6, verse 1. They're often mistaken for angels, but originally they weren't angels at all. Not only that, they're not even the main type of seraphim in the Bible. They're a small part of a network of related creatures, all called seraphim. Like many famous figures, they have some skeletons in the closet. The word seraphim appears in most English Bibles only in Isaiah's vision. In the original Hebrew, though, seraphim appear in several other texts, too, and each time they're a type of deadly serpent. Translators of the Bible handle this in a variety of ways, but rarely by using the word seraphim as they do in Isaiah chapter 6. This is a glaring example of a principle that my students would tell you I never tire of talking about. All translation is interpretation. In this case, translators decide that Isaiah's heavenly seraphim are unrelated to the deadly seraphim serpents in other texts. And so they leave the Hebrew word seraphim untranslated only in Isaiah chapter 6. Readers then have the impression that these creatures are unconnected. The total disconnect between the celestial and terrestrial seraphim isn't a matter of what's actually in the Bible, but of what we've been taught about the Bible. The earthly seraphim aren't your everyday serpents. In two of the four passages mentioning them, these snakes have, wait for it, wings. And those two passages? Also in Isaiah. Isaiah's heavenly seraphim, which he describes as flying around God's throne, are clearly related to the earthly creatures he calls flying seraphim, which are explicitly a type of snake. The two stories outside of Isaiah mentioning earthly seraphim, including the desert snake attack, refer to them in Hebrew as seraphim snakes, using the two nouns together. No wings are mentioned, So these seem to represent the naturalistic end of the seraphim spectrum, though not entirely natural, as we'll soon discuss. Recalling that monsters can be naturalistic, unnatural, or supernatural.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?